Welcome back to the program. Restaurants, reviews, and being a foodie have all become part of our culture. We sit here in the epicenter of American food, wine, and celebrity chefs, but this wasn't always the case. There was a time before food critics, before ethnic restaurants were often put on a par with fine dining, when it was every man for himself. All that changed back in the early 60s with New York Times reviewer Craig Claiborne. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Thomas McNamee. He's the author of a previous book on Alice Waters and Chez Panisse. His new book is The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat, Craig Claiborne in the American Food Renaissance. Thomas McNamee, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. Talk about how Claiborne landed the job at the New York Times and how this became something that started out in what was referred to at the time as kind of the women's pages.
Yeah, he was in the Army, in the Navy in Korea, and his last of his 3 years he spent on an almost abandoned little tiny island in the South Pacific with very little to do. He started to dream about what he was going to do with his life. By then, he was already 33, 34 years old, had no real aim in life. And he suddenly, he just decided, well, he loved food. He loved to cook. His mother was a great cook. He decided he would try to go to school somewhere and really learn it from a professional point of view. At first, he was going to go to the Cordon Bleu in Paris, but his mother got some information that this school in Switzerland was better, is the best of them all, the Hotel School of Lausanne. So he went there for 2 years, and as the longer he stayed and the better he got at cooking and at service and looking at the general landscape of American food, which was pretty sorry, he just said, you know, I think I'm going to try to become food editor of the New York Times. And at that point, as you say, it was nothing but a little section on the women's page, and it consisted of modest little reports of recipes that people had sent in, or the writer would say, oh, I had a lovely dinner at the Colony, had a steak and a martini. And he contrived through various means, once he got out of the school and moved to New York, got himself a job as a receptionist at Gourmet Magazine. Through that editor, got a connection to the outgoing editor of the Times, and just kind of smoothed his way on through with a lot of luck and a lot of careful planning, about half of each.
And he became the food editor back in 1957.
That's correct.
Talk about when he started doing more serious restaurant reviews, reviews that really started to get some attention.
At first, he really expected to have a field day among these great restaurants of New York. And so he started going to them immediately, but what he discovered was that most of them were just lousy. They were serving insufficiently fresh fish, they were serving frozen vegetables, they were serving little bits of black olive in place of truffles. And there was really only one great restaurant in the city, which was Le Pavillon. And after 2 years of being so totally fed up about it, he wrote a huge piece, which was put on the front page of the New York Times, about the total decline and disaster of food, not only in New York, but also across North America. And it's caused a tremendous scandal, all the restaurateurs raising hell, yelling back at the time, saying, well, this is not true, but it was true. And so gradually he started doing these little reviews. His earliest restaurant reviews were often as little as 100 words long, and half that information would be just the address and phone number of the restaurant. He'd say something like, you know, Pierre's French Restaurant is a delightful informal French restaurant in the theater district. And that would be the review. That'd be the whole thing. But as time went by, people were more and more interested, and people were often even picking up the Times on Friday morning and opening directly to the Craig Claiborne reviews to see what was out there that was new and interesting, or whom he might have trashed, although he did that rarely. And it just gradually grew into a bigger and bigger thing, and people were more and more interested in what he was doing, and so he gave them more about the restaurants.
And in the early 60s, he started looking seriously at kind of smaller ethnic restaurants, sometimes saying that they were better than places with a bigger reputation.
Exactly. His first, because of his training in formal French cooking, that's where he looked first. But he'd grown up in the Mississippi Delta, and so his mother had a boarding house where the food was extremely good. So he grew up with basic Southern food and also with Creole food from New Orleans that his mother had learned to cook. So he did have some experience of other than the highest level of formal French cooking in New York. There was no Southern cooking. There was no Creole cooking. So he just started to prowl around, and he found the Greek places on 9th Avenue. He discovered Chinatown and Little Italy. He discovered Spanish Harlem. And he discovered that brilliant cooking was taking place in all those places, and that New Yorkers at large didn't know anything about it, because to the extent that somebody who didn't live in Chinatown, non-Chinese person, went to Chinatown for dinner, which was not common, they would get a totally Americanized version of Chinese food. And what Craig sought out was the real thing, and he encouraged people to demand the real thing. And so neighborhood by neighborhood, cuisine by cuisine, he opened up these amazing pockets of international foods in New York City. And once again, it grew from there. People started going. They started having more and more authentic food. They started wanting to make it at home. And that led him to his cookbooks, which were often filled with exotic and unusual international food.
It wasn't long after that that the Times started publishing his directory to dining, which became a huge deal.
That's right. It's important to realize that there's really never been anything like it anywhere in the United States. There were food writers for newspapers, but they were mostly in the grip of advertisers. In other words, somebody opened a new restaurant in a town and they were going to advertise it in the newspaper. Well, the newspaper would favor them with a write-up, but it was nothing like real criticism. Craig wanted to be a critic on a par with the New York Times critics of dance and music and literature and art. And so he brought very serious and rigorous standards to it. And that had never been done before. The whole idea of a real live restaurant critic who played fair, played by the rules, paid for his own meals, went in anonymously, took other people anonymously, and judged the food simply on the basis of what it was, that was completely new.
It was also a sense, as he reviewed better and better restaurants, there was a sense that American restaurants would start to matter, and he played a big role in that.
That's right. Inevitably, as people found that restaurants were better, it became something to do as entertainment. An evening out in a restaurant, what could be an evening's entertainment. It used to be, you know, you might run out and get something quickly before going to the movies or the theater or a ball game. And the idea that you could actually spend a couple or more hours in a restaurant just enjoying the food and one another's company, that was also something he really put on the map. It was not something that was very common at all. Equally so, in people's homes, the classic American situation of a dinner party would be where the housewife was off in the kitchen working away, and everybody else was out in the living room having cocktails. The idea that we might all stand around with a glass of wine in our hands in a big kitchen and kind of whether participating in the kitchen in the cooking literally or just being there and having fun watching the food being prepared, this whole idea that's mostly very common at dinner parties today, people stand around, mm-hmm. enjoy themselves in the kitchen before they go sit down to eat. That, again, was something that Craig brought into being.
The idea of the open kitchens we see today in many restaurants is something that really grew out of this period.
That's right. He was the first person, at least that I know of, ever in the United States to have restaurant equipment in his kitchen. And that, in turn, necessitated, of course, a big prep area, a big island in the middle. And so, as he wrote about the dinner parties that he gave, particularly once he had bought a house in East Hampton on Long Island where he had more room, he would write about these dinner parties, and there would be photographs in the New York Times Magazine of Craig and his friends all laughing and having a big time around this big kitchen. And people started to say to themselves, gosh, I'd like to have one of those.
Talk a little bit about the standards that he would set for himself, because one of the things that he talks about a lot are really what he considered to be very high standards he set.
Yes. The other restaurant, other food writers were mostly not very honest. They were in the hands of their employer's advertisers. Craig decided that his standards were going to be absolute. He would go a minimum of 3 times to a restaurant with at least 4 people in the party each time. All the food would be paid for by the New York Times. It would be completely anonymous. And he would write about the food and the service very analytically. That had never been done before.
How did the more fine dining establishments feel at the time about him taking seriously some of these smaller restaurants, whether it was a pizzeria somewhere or whether it was the donuts at Chock Full of Nuts?
Well, I think ultimately, I'm sure at first they were annoyed, but ultimately it acted as a great stimulus to them in a couple of ways. One was that they were going to be losing customers to places like this. People were going to go off and discover that for a quarter the price of a meal, a French meal in Midtown, you could have a magnificent banquet in Chinatown. The other thing that happened was that influences from that kind of cooking began to make themselves felt in the higher-end restaurants. New kinds of ingredients, whether it be cilantro or lemongrass or arugula. Arugula was brand new. Only the Italians had that. Those things started to find their way into the higher-end restaurants. And so after a while, there was quite a healthy cross-fertilization going on.
One of the other things that happened is that other newspapers, other publications, all felt all of a sudden they needed their own version of a restaurant critic.
That's true. They did. And, of course, today I think every newspaper in America has a restaurant critic. Unfortunately, they're not always as clean as Craig was. Some say, well, you know, some publication owners will tell you that it's, oh, we don't have the budget to pay for our critic to pay for our critic's meals. And so the critic will actually accept a freebie meal from the restaurant. And, of course, as soon as that happens, they know exactly who you are. They're giving you everything in the best. They've got the best waiter. They're basically bribing you. And there's still way too much of that. But there are, of course, plenty of good, honest restaurant critics as well. Good ones, too.
How did Claiborne see the competition? There was a reviewer that came along for the Herald Tribune. I mean, there was Duncan Hines came along. I mean, suddenly he had all this competition. How did he view that?
Well, I don't think he worried about it too much because I think he knew that he was superior, and he knew that the New York Times was a superior position from which to express his authority. And the only really good, serious competition that I'm aware of that he had in his early days was Gail Green from New York Magazine. It was a very different kind of writer. She wrote this very lavish, highly stylized restaurant criticism. It was kind of fun, but totally unlike Craig's, which was very foursquare and serious. I think, you know, people often compared him to James Beard, but James Beard, first of all, was not a critic. And James Beard also had I wouldn't say he was totally corrupt, but he had a lot of corruption in his life. He represented foods and wines and things for money, and he wouldn't tell you that he was taking the money. He just endorsed something.
By the early 70s, he had started to get extremely jaded. He also was drinking a whole heck of a lot. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think maybe it's a matter of just too much of a good thing. He did drink too much. He always drank too much, actually, but it got worse. And he really did get tired of restaurant reviewing. He felt guilty, actually, about saying bad things about restaurants. His mother had always said to him, Craig, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And it was very hard for him to give a restaurant a negative review because often it would ruin their business. He didn't like the fact that when he gave a restaurant a rave review, suddenly the place would be mobbed for the next 6 months and people couldn't get a reservation. He was disillusioned with the amount of power he had and, frankly, bored. It felt like the same thing over and over again to him. But a lot of this goes to his alcoholism, which was losing him friends. It was making him behave badly sometimes. He was sometimes quite awful to his friends. He just gradually wanted to pull out of the reviewing business, and he actually quit the Times in 1972 to start his own magazine, a Craig Claiborne Journal, which ran for about 2 years and went broke. He went back to the Times. By the time he came back, he was no longer the restaurant reviewer. He was the food editor because there was a whole new section by then. The whole thing had grown to the point where it was actually a weekly section in the paper, and they had other reviewers. But although he was still the boss, and if there was still something important to be looked at, he was the one who did it.
Talk about the way restaurants had changed in New York during this 10-15-year period, really in many ways in direct response to what Claiborne was doing.
Absolutely, in direct response. He demanded freshness. He demanded precision. He demanded honesty in the food, that what it said it was going to be on the menu, it would be, that it was, you know, if it was sweetbreads with truffles, the truffles had to be truffles. And if it was foie gras, he wanted it to be fresh foie gras. He insisted on freshness in everything. And the standards of the whole city rose and rose in response to his demands for quality.
At one point in the 70s, when he was becoming jaded by all this, and as we talked about drinking too much, he injured himself. He fell. He was so drunk.
Yeah. That happened to him several times. One time he just passed out on the sidewalk from probably excess blood pressure. Another time he was hit by a cab, where he was probably wandering around in the wrong, not on the sidewalk, and ended up in the emergency room. And I actually have a diagram that the emergency room gave him that day, where they'd done a sonogram of his head, of his heart, and had shown these blockages in the arteries leading to his heart. He was already had advanced heart disease in his 50s. And he did absolutely nothing for quite a long time about it, until he finally ran into a doctor who insisted that he reduce the amount of salt in his diet, which he did. So his idea of a soft drink used to be to drink a glass of sauerkraut juice. He was a salt addict. But certainly heart disease did begin to slow him down, and ultimately killed him.
To what extent did restaurants start to shape their food, shape what they were doing, based on what they knew would please Claiborne?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that they did, I don't think they did in terms of what they served. I think they took an extra amount of care, and that they were much cleaner and more honest about the food they were serving. But because Claiborne's tastes were so wide, he loved everything. He loved hot dogs. He loved chili. He loved foie gras. He loved souffles. He loved these spectacularly fancy assemblies like turkey galantines. So you couldn't really predict, if you were a restaurateur or a chef, you couldn't predict what Craig was going to like.
What do you think is his largest legacy in terms of food and restaurants?
I don't know if I can single out one thing, but one thing that I always think about is the liberation of the home cook. Home cooking had, pre-Craig, had been sort of just considered drudgery. And the fact that it's now an enjoyable hobby for millions of Americans, and it's something that people do together and really enjoy doing together, that's new. Also, the fact that men were free to be cooks. It had been almost, home cooking had been almost exclusively the realm of women. And for the first time, he made it perfectly socially acceptable for a man to do something other than stand out by the grill.
Tell us a little bit about chefs and his relationship with chefs.
So when he was first working at the Times and decrying the quality of all the bad restaurants there, he did love this one French restaurant called Le Pavillon, and he wrote about it as being the ne plus ultra of New York restaurants. And there was a young chef there named Pierre Frenet, who a couple of years after that first piece got into a big battle with the restaurant's owner over money. And Craig wrote that up too, and put a picture of the owner of the restaurant looking like a big fat idiot on the front page of the Times, and next to it, a picture of his now buddy, Pierre Frenet, looking like a movie star. And that was the first time a chef had ever been featured in the news as a person. Otherwise, chefs were servants. They were just back there in the kitchen somewhere. You never saw them. You never knew who they were. And so Pierre became his writing partner for almost 30 years. But in the meantime, all along, because of Pierre's being a chef and because Craig's particular fondness for chefs and his recognition that they were the people really responsible for what was going to come out of the kitchen, he developed friendships with chefs. And sometimes he thought, well, this person deserves recognition. And this was true both for restaurant chefs and for home cooks. Like Marcella Hazan was just a woman in an apartment who had actually learned to cook Italian food in New York, even though she was Italian by birth. And he put her in the paper and said, Marcella, you should write a cookbook. Well, she did. And, of course, Marcella Hazan's classic Italian cookbook is still probably the standard for all Italian cookbooks in the United States. Loved chefs because he loved their dedication to the craft. He loved how hard they worked. And of course, they shared an interest in cooking.
It also had an interesting impact on the restaurateurs who saw themselves as the celebrities, not the chefs, and then that would begin to change.
That's true. The pattern often in France, since way before Craig, was that the restaurateur and the chef were the same person. And so there were sort of star chefs in France, like Fernand Point, before anything like that had happened in the United States. And so, and you're right, it was often a dual system here where you had an owner who was the considered himself the personification of the restaurant, and the chef who was back in the kitchen. Craig really liked that idea of the chef-owner, and so over his first, say, 10 years at the Times, that became a much more common pattern in New York City. I think he did dislodge some people who considered themselves the heroes of the story in favor of their lower-down competitor, the chef.
How do you think he'd view the world of food and celebrity chefs today?
I often think he'd look at it and say, oh, my God, did I start all of this? because I think it has grown to such an amazing extent, way, way beyond anything he would have imagined. I mean, he loved chefs for being chefs. The other day, when I was watching, I think, Chopped on television, a guy came on who was sort of talking about how he was going to do that evening, and he said, you know, I think the lighting is really good with my skin tones. You know, and if Craig heard a chef talking like that, he'd want to beat him over the head with a frying pan. He loved chefs for being chefs, and the idea that now chefing is often a matter of public relations and showmanship, I think that would be, he would find that, yes, it is his legacy, but it also is his legacy gone kind of haywire.
Thomas McNamee, the book is The Man Who Changed the Way We Eat, Craig Claiborne and the American Food Renaissance. Thomas, I thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Jeff, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you.